Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome in this latest OIES podcast. This one is being brought to you by the GAS programme. My name's James Henderson. I am Head of GAS Research at OIES. And with me today, I have Graham Bethune, who is the chairman of EnergyQuest in Australia and is also a senior visiting research fellow. He has written a paper for us called Is Australia Quietly Quitting the LNG Business? And we're going to discuss that rather provocative title over the next half an hour or so. I'll just date this podcast, just so everyone knows when we're talking. It's the 14th of June, and it is the morning here in the UK, and it's the middle of the afternoon in Adelaide, where Graham is speaking to us from. So, Graham, welcome to the podcast for the first time.
Hi there, Jim. A pleasure to be here.
Great. Well, look, let's, first of all, then, before we get into the meat of your paper, perhaps you could give us a quick overview of the Australian gas market. Let's start with the domestic market. How important is gas in Australia, and what's the kind of geography of demand?
Gas is very important. Gas is about, or nearly 30% of primary energy consumption, which is pretty similar to coal, actually, so less than oil, but one of the three major forms of energy used in Australia. But the use of gas varies significantly between states.
Okay, so what is that geography of demand then? Where's gas demand sort of most prevalent?
The biggest domestic market is in Western Australia, particularly for industrial projects and for mining, but also for power generation, but with a very small retail market. Victoria, on the other hand, is the second biggest, very large retail market. Not much use of gas for power generation, but some use for industrial. Then after that, you've got Queensland and New South Wales, fairly low retail markets, but quite important industrial markets. Then South Australia, which is smaller still. So it's very, 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 very spread out and different market segments.
Okay, well, talk to me about production a bit as well, and particularly production for the domestic market, but also the big export projects that we all know about. Can you give us kind of an overview of the kind of resource base in production, and then what are those key LNG projects?
Sure. The largest LNG projects, or the largest LNG producing state, is Western Australia, and the resource base for that is the offshore Carnarvon Basin, about halfway up the West Australian coast. So that's all offshore, and Carnarvon Basin gas is used for both LNG, for the four LNG projects in Western Australia, and also for most West Australian domestic gas. On the east coast, the three LNG projects at Queensland are supplied with coal seam gas, the only LNG projects in the world to have coal seam gas. On the east coast, also conventional gas for the domestic market is supplied offshore Victoria and from the Cooper Basin in central Australia.
What kind of percentage is exported, and who are the main customers for that, over those exports?
LNG really dominates everything else. Depends a bit how you measure it, because quite a lot of gas is actually used for LNG production. But if you take that away, LNG is about five times the size of the Australian domestic markets. So there's about 112 BCM exported, compared to about 25 BCM used domestically. The main customers are all in North Asia, so it's a fairly concentrated supply chain. The biggest customer is Japan, followed by China, followed by South Korea, and followed by Taiwan, and that accounts for around 90% of Australian exports.
Okay, well, now we've talked about those kind of export customers, we'll get on to the kind of rather provocative title of your paper. I mean, given the size of the asset base that you've described, you know, why are you even suggesting that Australia might be quietly exiting the LNG business? Are customers getting concerned? Why?
Well, I think the customer concerns have really been sparked by government moves to introduce provisions whereby LNG or gas directed for LNG could be diverted into the domestic sector. But looking at it more fundamentally and over a longer period, the fundamental problem is the failure to replace gas reserves, and that's for a number of reasons. Lack of exploration, CO2 in prospective developments, and also very, very significant opposition. So you've got, on the one hand, you've got existing fields declining, you've got peak domestic demand increasing with the energy transition, and you've also got a number of fields that are fairly significant with CO2. So on the one hand, you've got increasing domestic demand and a lot of constraints on development while a lot of existing fields are declining.
Okay, so we'll get into that in a bit more detail in the rest of the conversation. In your paper, I think you mentioned that some countries that are buying Australian gas have actually kind of voiced their concerns. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, it's interesting. It's particularly the Japanese who are the major buyers from Western Australia, but in fact they're much smaller buyers from Queensland. And initially, the concerns about domestic gas supply were centred on Queensland, and the biggest buyer from Queensland is China. So nearly 20% of Chinese LNG exports come from Queensland. But it's actually the Japanese who've raised the issue, particularly the Japanese company INPEX, who operate the Ichthys plant in Darwin, but also now followed on by concerns raised by JERA, the major Japanese LNG buyer, and also by Tokyo Gas, who were obviously concerned that what might transpire in Australia would not only affect the East Coast, but could also affect their interests in the Northern Territory and Western Australia.
In your paper, you sort of point out the Australian government has given some assurances. Perhaps you can tell us about those. But then you also highlight the challenges that you've kind of identified. So why don't we go into some of those? I mean, first, you know, what was the Australian government response? But then if we start with the resource base, I mean, why are you concerned that it might not be sufficient? I mean, are there not enough reserves left in the fields? What's going on?
There are some situations of that. And I think we probably need to distinguish between threats of breaching contracts versus just the lack of opportunity to write new contracts. Certainly, the threat of breaching contracts is probably greatest in Queensland on the East Coast. That reflects the fact that the resource base there, based on coal seam gas, is less secure than in conventional gas fields, and that's always been seen to be the case. And previous papers from the Institute have highlighted that. But at the same time, you've got an increasing decline in the historical legacy field supply in the East Coast, from particularly fields from offshore Victoria. And at the same time, you've got the energy transition trying to transition from 80% of electricity being generated from coal down to like 40% or 30%, or you know, as low as it can go. So from the politician's point of view, where can you get gas? Given that there are also restrictions on new development, well, the obvious contenders are the LNG projects. So that's that's really the catalyst of a lot of the concern. But as I said, the biggest buyers from Queensland are the Chinese, not the Japanese, but it's really been the Japanese who've been the most vocal. The Chinese, Korea and Singapore have also expressed concerns too.
So let me just kind of summarise and correct me if I'm wrong. So essentially what we're saying is that production domestically designed for the domestic market is in decline. The coal seam gas resources are somewhat challenged. Demand is rising because of the shift away from coal. And therefore, that combination is creating, if you like, a concern for politicians. You mention in your paper about this kind of peak demand for electricity while coal is in decline. Could you go into a little bit more about that and what's happening on the demand side in East Australia?
Eastern Australia has been very, very reliant on coal-fired generation. That sort of peaked at about 80%, probably sort of similar to South Africa, for example, in terms of reliance on coal. Now, that's starting to decline very quickly as renewables grow. So renewables are growing quickly. Aging coal-fired power stations can't compete with renewables and are increasingly taken offline and are also having challenges in operability as well. In winter last year, we had a situation where of pretty cold weather, cloudy skies affecting renewables, a lot of coal stations that were offline due to maintenance or unplanned breakdowns. The net result was that the only fuel source left standing was gas. And then suddenly, almost overnight, gas had to go from sort of 5% of power generation to double to around 10%, with obvious results for gas prices too.
In your paper, I mean, obviously you talk about that and the energy crisis on the East Coast in June, which is obviously Australian winter 2022. You've talked about gas demand rising. Essentially, did then domestic demand immediately take priority over exports? And you also talk about the Australian domestic gas security mechanism. Perhaps you could talk us through what actually happened in terms of gas flows during that crisis?
Probably more than LNG exports got the blame. I mean, the LNG exports weren't at a peak anyway. I mean, this was in the middle of the northern summer, so there was a lower demand, and as generally happens, gas was flowing south from Queensland from the LNG producers to the southern states. But there was certainly a big and there was no formal restriction on LNG exports. What did happen was that there were significant big increases in gas prices, which also coincided, for that matter, also with a big increase in international prices too. So the argument was that LNG exporters are profiting from high international prices and selling the gas internationally and forcing up electricity prices, whereas what really happened was these failures in domestic electricity generation led to a doubling in the demand for gas, which then led to increases in gas prices. But all of that catalysed a lot of government concern about how to control electricity prices, basically. And as a result, they introduced a cap on gas prices and also a cap on coal prices too for power generation.
The price cap came in. How did that affect producers, both of LNG, producers selling to LNG plants, but producers selling to the domestic market? Were there any policy kind of decisions made which, coming back to your the title of your paper, could impact the LNG business in the medium to longer term?
The introduction of a cap on gas prices obviously discourages investment, and what happened pretty quickly was a number of producers came out and said that they were cancelling investment projects. They didn't all do that, but certainly some of them did that. So that creates even more concern about supply and demand in future. I mean, the government on the whole claimed that shouldn't happen, that the gas price cap that was introduced was significantly above the cost of production, and they couldn't see why it would impact on investment. But obviously, it sent a very worrying message to the industry. At the same time, as the future of gas demand is uncertain anyway with the energy transition, so you've got a situation where even though oil prices have been quite high, exploration has been in the doldrums, which isn't what's happened historically. And then the federal government also introduced a much tougher Australian domestic gas security mechanism. So this was first introduced in 2017, but was significantly toughened up this year, so that the resources minister or a number of ministers collectively make a decision each year about whether they believe there'll be sufficient gas, and if not, whether exports should be restricted. And they have the scope there to even restrict exports under long-term contracts. Another important aspect, though, too, is that the legislation that was passed can also apply to, needn't apply, but it can apply to the Northern Territory and to Western Australia. And so that's I think, one of the things that particularly caused concerns for the Japanese, even though they're not that exposed to Queensland exports. They are exposed to the Northern Territory and Western Australia.
Which takes me on to my next question, which is whether there's a risk that similar crises could occur in Northern Australia and Western Australia. I mean, is the East Coast relatively unique, or are we looking at potential problems elsewhere in Australia?
I think they would happen in different ways. There is already a sort of quiet crisis in the Northern Territory. I mean, the Northern Territory is a pretty small gas market, and gas is mainly used for power generation. But the Darwin, the capital of the Northern Territory, has been supplied for gas from a single field called Blacktip, operated by ENI. And the Blacktip field has been having significant problems. So production has fallen significantly, and there are emergency provisions in relation to the LNG projects in the Northern Territory to supply gas into the domestic market, and that is in fact occurring now. So we see similar problems arise just from the sort of collapse of a single field. In Western Australia, there is a domestic gas supply requirement different to the East Coast. But what's happening in Western Australia is you've got legacy domestic fields declining. And you've also got the North West Shelf declining too. And it's quite possible that the West Australian government and the federal government could require the LNG producers to supply more to the domestic market if it can't be done from domestic gas fields.
You've mentioned exploration already and said that it's kind of declined because of concerns over future demand with the energy transition. But is more exploration in the short term to meet some of these kind of imbalances in supply and demand a potential answer? Is there new gas to find in Australia? And if so, you know, are any incentives being provided to go and look for it?
Good question. There is more gas to find. And one good example of that is in the Perth Basin, actually fairly close to Perth. So most of Perth's gas suppliers come from the Carnarvon Basin, a long way away. A couple of smaller companies looking for shale gas to frack stumbled upon very good conventional gas in a field called Waits here, and there have been other discoveries since too. Those fields are now being developed despite low West Australian gas prices. Some of those volumes are going to be also supplied to the North West Shelf for LNG. So I think that does just go to show that there's always potential for gas, and even where you least expect to find it. On the other hand, in the East Coast, in New South Wales and Victoria, onshore exploration has effectively been prohibited. Certainly there are significant gas to be found in New South Wales. The other aspect of that too is to distinguish between what petroleum engineers define as reserves and contingent resources. Contingent resources are gas that's been found but cannot be developed either for technical reasons or for commercial reasons. Now the volumes of contingent resources in Australia are about the same as the volumes of reserves. So very, very, very substantial volumes of gas. Price isn't a major prohibitor because gas prices are high and oil prices are relatively high too. But certainly a lot of these fields do have CO2, so which is a significant constraint on development and a constraint that, as you would expect, is getting much tighter too compared to what it used to be.
Let's come on to that then. I mean, you talk about environmental commitments in your paper. You've mentioned the sort of bans on fracking in some of the East Coast states. And now you've mentioned kind of CO2. Are the environmental lobby groups very powerful, and are they essentially kind of undermining the future development of gas in Australia? Let's start with that. What about the lobby groups?
Well, they are very powerful. I mean, they're not alone. I mean, the gas industry decided to undertake huge onshore development in Queensland in farming land. On the whole, farmers in Queensland were willing to accept that. Less so in New South Wales and Victoria. They were also championed, I guess, by environmental groups. One very prevalent one in Australia is called Lock the Gate, which has been very successful and has been operating since for over a decade and is affiliated with Friends of the Earth. But they've been very successful in constraining development. And what's happening increasingly too is just litigation. So even in cases where governments have approved or regulators have approved a development, environmental groups have been able to go to the courts and get those approvals overturned. So that's happening currently in the Northern Territory in relation to a field called Barossa, which Santos is aiming to develop to backfill the Darwin LNG plant. The federal regulator gave environmental approval to go ahead, but then that was then there were court actions taken against that, which overturned the approval, and they've had to go back to square one to go through the whole approval process again.
Okay, I mean, so obviously that's a concern for gas development. Coming back to the CO2 issue, what about plans for carbon capture, utilization, and storage? Is CCUS the answer, and what's being done if it is?
I'm not sure whether it's definitely the answer, but it certainly better be the answer. And it's important that it works. The Australian industry recently had its annual conference about oil and gas, but oil was hardly mentioned, and it was like a CCUS conference, really. So huge focus on CCUS. One operating project in Australia is the Gorgon CCS project in Western Australia, which has been able to sequester about 8 million tonnes of CO2, which is more than anybody else has been able to sequester, I think. However, that's only about a third of what was promised originally, largely for technical and geological reasons. And I think one of the things that comes through is that a lot of the discussion about these things tends to be political rather than geological. the success or not of projects does depend a lot on the geology. Santos is currently out developing a CCUS project at Moomba in Central Australia, so we'll start to know fairly soon how successful that is. There are about another 16 projects being proposed in Australia, so certainly it's a big thrust on CCS.
Okay, and you talk about in your paper about the Australian safeguard mechanism. Can you just explain what that is a little and what the implications of that are?
Yes, I mean, one of the things that's happened is the new Labor government has come into office with a much higher emissions reduction target to replace what was arguably a target that was too low under the previous government, which was 26 to 28%, but they've come in with a 42%. This applies to all industrial projects in Australia and has requirements for annual reductions in emissions. For LNG or for gas projects, however, any new gas projects have to be net zero from day one. So this includes both new greenfield projects, but also backup projects for existing facilities. So that is a major challenge. The only way that can be done, apart from CCS, is through offsets. Given the time it may take to develop CCS and at the scale required, then there is likely to be a very strong need for offsets as well.
And is that net zero scope one and scope two? It's presumably not scope three as well?
No. Scope one and scope two.
Okay. And you've mentioned the new government. I mean, are there any other new policies being introduced, or is the Australian safeguard mechanism the main one? Is there anything else that's affecting the industry?
Well, the gas price cap, the much tougher ADGSM. The government's also revised the taxation for offshore LNG projects. Taxation of the offshore projects has been based on a petroleum rent resource tax, under which you recoup the cost of the project and then pay tax at a 40% rate on the profits. The problem has been that because the Australian projects were so expensive when they were built, it meant that nobody was ever going to have to pay PRRT on LNG projects. So they've made some changes to that, which on the whole weren't unexpected. The industry has kind of accepted them, but one of the things that is industry is finding difficulty is the kind of stacking of policy changes over a relatively short time.
Okay, well, look, you've highlighted quite a number of issues over the last sort of 25 minutes or so. Let's bring this to the conclusion. Should buyers of Australian LNG be concerned? Is Australia quietly quitting the LNG business? What's your overall conclusion in the paper?
Certainly that buyers on the East Coast with foundation contracts, there is certainly a risk of those being breached within the life of the contracts, not necessarily this year or next year, but certainly this decade. That's also actually a possibility in the Northern Territory, but not a terribly material one given the small amounts of gas involved. In Western Australia, it's probably more lack of opportunity that any Japanese buyer or Korean buyer or Chinese buyer who was thinking that they'd always be able to buy more or write more contracts with Australia, I think is probably going to find that that's more difficult, pushing them then into other markets, so like Qatar or the US or African or other Middle Eastern projects.
So effectively, you do see Australian LNG exports going into decline, later this decade or into the 2030s?
Yes, certainly by 2030. I mean, I think it's reasonable to take the view that exports are probably peaking currently, and by 2030 could be 65 to 70 million tonnes a year rather than 82 million tonnes. That would still leave Australia as one of the world's biggest LNG exporters, but in the sort of decline phase. And probably regarded as a bit less reliable than it has been in the past.
Okay, Graham, well, look, that's been a fascinating conversation. Thanks so much for your insights. It's been a really excellent discussion of the challenges facing the Australian LNG business. I would send any listeners to our website to download your paper, which was published yesterday, the 13th of June. It's entitled, Is Australia Quietly Quitting the LNG Business? It's an excellent read, and congratulations on its publication. But thank you for now, Graham, for your contribution to the podcast. Thanks to all our listeners for tuning in again. Take care of yourselves and goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our original research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.